David Horner, the first two rules, the most important decision is whether to commit to war, then the level and nature of the commitment. What does history tell Australia about those fundamental rules?
One of the things that we can notice from the nine wars I've dealt with from 1914 through to 2003 is the commitment to war is not always a decision being made by the Australian government. In the First World War, in effect, we went to war because the British Empire was at war. And the Prime Minister in the Second World War, Menzies, believed that was the case and again committed us to war. But in the wars since then, from the Korean War through to 2003, it was a decision to be made by the government. And I've said in the book that it's the most important, gravest decision any government can make is to send us off to war. And we made those decisions from the Korean War through to 2003.
And this second point, it is about the level of commitment, a very finely judged level of commitment, how far and how hard Australia goes.
That is right. The decision is how much will we commit to the war. In the First World War, we committed a certain number of troops at the beginning, 20,000, and then that quickly got bigger and bigger. As I argue in the book, it probably got to a point that we could not sustain. Again, in the Second World War, we made a very large commitment in numbers of troops, ships and planes as well, and we could not sustain it during the war and had to be cut back during the war. And then you need to also consider the nature of the commitment. Is it going to be troops on the ground? Is it going to be ships, planes? In the Gulf War in 1991, the Hawke government decided to commit ships, but as I said, they did not want to have boots on the ground. Boots on the ground has the possibility of casualties. So we're also looking at the nature of the commitment. Are they going to be troops, or is it going to be ships and planes, or a combination of those?
Now, the next trio of rules sit together. The war leader is not the font of all wisdom, the need to trust military commanders, and ensure that operations follow Australia's policy and interests. How do you gather those together?
What Menzies did in the Second World War is he established a war cabinet, a small group of senior ministers who would make the decisions about the war. And we've seen this continued on during the Second World War. It also had the Advisory War Council. Then the Menzies government in the Vietnam War had the Foreign Affairs and Defence Committee of the cabinet, and more recently Howard had the National Security Committee of cabinet. So it's not just the Prime Minister by himself, but it's this group of senior ministers. And in each case, they brought into this group of senior ministers their top military advisers. Now, they're advisers, they're not decision makers, but the chiefs of staff would go and sit in the war cabinet, and right through now to the present time, the National Security Committee of Cabinet would have the Secretary of the Department of Defence, would have the Chief of the Defence Force. The government, therefore, also has a role of selecting and making sure that they have the best and most suitable military advisors. So the appointment of these chiefs, and more recently the Chief of the Defence Force, is an important decision the government makes. Beyond that, the government also needs to have a commander in the field who ensures that the operations are being conducted in accordance with government policy. Because after all, it's the government that's decided to go to war, and they've decided the nature of the commitment. Therefore, they need to have a way of controlling how our operations are going. And we saw an example of this during the 2003 invasion of Iraq, when Brigadier Maury McNahan was the commander in the Middle East. And at one time, the Americans directed our RAAF Hornet fighters, to attack a particular position where there may have been civilian casualties, and that would have been contrary to Australian government policy. And Brigadier McNahan said, no, those aircraft are not going to be used for that. The jargon term is to hold up the red card to ensure that Australian government policy is followed. So these are the mechanisms that are there to enable the Prime Minister and the senior ministers to conduct the war after they've made the decision to go to go to war.
In terms of the Canberra mechanism, which is one of the central things this book is about, the National Security Committee of Cabinet that John Howard created, which has now been operating at the heart of the Australian system for 25 years, how much does the NSC go to what you're discussing, the need for these rules about how the system works, and both supporting and partly not necessarily being a check, but as another means of informing the way the Prime Minister goes about using this incredible power to go to war?
Well, you're right about informing, but I would take a little bit further. I've talked in the book about the Prime Ministers who led us into those nine wars that I've talked about, and it's more than nine Prime Ministers because there was changeovers along the way. And of all the Prime Ministers I discussed, only one, John Gorton, had any military experience, and he was a fighter pilot, and he was very quick to say he has no training as a strategist. So invariably, the Prime Minister who finds himself in this position comes without any proper background in it. And I think having a thing like the National Security Committee of Cabinet that deals with strategic and international issues on a frequent basis is a way in which the Prime Minister can be, if you like, educated on these issues. And by having the top military people there, civilian and uniformed, who have had years of training in this area, they can help inform and educate the ministers about these issues. So having the National Security Committee of Cabinet is a most valuable part of government.
It's an unusual system, isn't it, that you get the Chief of the Defence Force, the Secretary of the Defence Department, the Secretary of Foreign Affairs, sitting around the decision-making table with their ministers, making those decisions and having those arguments.
That is right. It is important. It might seem a little bit unusual, but it has been the way ever since Menzies had the War Cabinet in the Second World War to bring in these advisers to sit there. But they are only advisers, and they only can give advice when they're asked. They're not there to try to make policy. And politicians, in particular prime ministers, are very clever on all this, that they will ask for the sort of advice that they want. We don't know what went on in the National Security Committee of Cabinet when we went to the invasion of Iraq. Did the Prime Minister say, Chief of the Defence Force, do you think this is a good idea? Or did he say to the Chief of the Defence Force, I think we ought to go to Iraq, you give me some advice on how to do it?
It's pretty clear, I think, from what some of the participants have told us since, that John Howard didn't actually ask for any contrary advice because he was worried about how that would be used, possibly leaked, and the problems it would make for the government in making the case for war.
Well, of course, I haven't had access to the records for the invasion of Iraq in 2003. I have seen the records for all the other wars that I have talked about. And if we look at them, in many cases, no, the government did not ask the question of should we go. On the other hand, quite often you had military people double-guessing the government. When this is right or not, it's another matter, but double-guessing the government and saying, well, perhaps the government would like us to go, and therefore we'll jump straight to the issue of how to go.
Start making the plans.
Start making the plans, that's right, which is essentially what happened in the invasion of Kuwait in the first Gulf War. It's pretty clear that Hawke wanted to go, but it's also clear that the military had, in their view, sussed out that we ought to go anyway. So,
because Washington was sending us some signals.
I've written in the book that our defence advisor in Washington saw that this thing is on and perhaps we ought to be in on it, and sent that message back to Canberra.
Now, rules 6 and 7. Get access to allied strategic decision-making, but also Australia must have its own intelligence gathering capability. How do they both complement and oppose?
Right from the time we went to the First World War, right through to now, this has been a problem. I mean, it's well known that the Australian troops landed at Gallipoli and the Australian government found out about it a few days later. The government was not consulted. They were not involved in the Allied, in that case, British Imperial decision-making. Prime Minister Hughes in the First World War tried to get access. Menzies and Curtin in the Second World War struggled over this issue, and it has been a continuing issue the whole way through. And it's all very well to have a top level and very capable Australian ambassador in Washington, but is he going to be consulted about the higher strategic decision making? And the answer is probably not. So the Australian government has struggled with this over the whole period of time, and the best I can say is that we've got to be alert to it the whole time. It will help a lot if we do have an intelligence gathering capacity of our own. Of course, in the First World War, we only had one representative overseas, the High Commissioner in London. We've now got a much larger diplomatic service, access to information, and we also need our own intelligence gathering structure so that we can have our own view about what is happening and not rely on the intelligence gathering of one of our allies.
Rules number 8 and 9, manage the politics, manage the media, hold the government together, persuade the country. How have different prime ministers met those needs?
Those issues have again been consistent, although they're different in their nature, but the issues have been the same since the First World War right through to now. In the First World War, for example, where Billy Hughes was quite ruthless in dealing with opposition to the war, and he split his own party, the Labour Party, over conscription. So we see the politics playing there. In the Second World War, people have been critical of Menzies in the first 2 years as a war leader. He wasn't so bad as the war leader, but where he failed was on the political side, and it was his own party who got rid of him in the end. Something that he learned for the future.
An extraordinary moment of Australian democracy, that a government falls in the middle of probably Australia's most important war in the sense of the country's own future.
That is a reminder that the political leader has to have the political side all sewn up as well. And Curtin, of course, was struggling with that. He wanted to use conscripted soldiers overseas, and he had to win that argument within his party before he could put it to the Parliament. And then we've seen it subsequently right through to de Hawke, who had to win over the left wing of his own party before he went to the 1991 Gulf War, and Howard, who had to make sure that there was no opposition within his own party, and then, you can put it this way, to wedge the opposition such that he could send people off to the invasion of Iraq in 2003. So you've got the political side, and hand in glove with that, you've got the media side to, if you like, sell the message to the Australian public about what the troops are doing and how the commitment should be supported.
And that brings us to Rule 10, which in a way is that there are no rules, that the war leadership lives in uncertainty. So how good then are your other rules up against that great uncertainty of war?
There is a great uncertainty, but the sorts of rules that I've talked about are, I don't know if you want to use the word set, but they have appeared again and again over a 100-year period. And they will continue to appear because prime ministers will need to get advice. We do need to have intelligence gathering. So those other rules will still apply, and if applied with as much diligence as the government can apply to them, they will help deal with this final matter of it's always an area of uncertainty, because we don't know how things are going to pan out. And here's a matter about rules of the game. There is an opposition who are also playing the game, and they might be playing to different rules, and you don't know how they're going to react. So there's always that area of uncertainty that overhangs this decision, this matter of war leadership, which, as I say, is the most important matter that the government has to deal with.
What's your view of this debate that has rumbled in Canberra for the last couple of decades since Iraq, that there perhaps should be some limits on this absolute power of an Australian Prime Minister to decide for war, that there should be some way for the Australian Parliament to have a role, perhaps some vote by the Australian Parliament within, say, 60 days of a deployment. Should there be some new limits on this great power of an Australian Prime Minister?
I've come to the conclusion that perhaps there should be some limit on the power of the Prime Minister and the government to make these decisions, because, as I said, these are the most important decisions. They result in the deaths to Australians, tragedy for the family, the financial cost to Australia, the cost to Australia's reputation. If there was an emergency, the government has to have the capacity to react straight away. But for so many of the commitments that we've made since the Second World War, it was not absolutely vital that we go into operations straight away, tomorrow. No. There was always a period of time. Now, that maybe there's a political imperative with our allies to make an announcement. On the other hand, if we had delayed in so many of those commitments, would it have made the difference? And that leads to the consideration that with these decisions being extremely important and far-reaching, whether there should be some mechanism by which the government has to put the decision to the people of Australia through the Parliament.
David Horner, thank you very much.
My pleasure.